for me, music was like the air you breathe. I regret selling everything I sold when I was when I was young.
Sure.
I would love to have kept it all. It is kind of amazing the difference cables make. That's what I've found. It seems like women are somewhat averse to the whole complicated system idea.
Leslie Landin é a convidada deste episódio do podcast Música e Som, onde nos explica como chegou a presidente da Audiophile Foundation. A associação sem fins lucrativos tem sede em São Francisco e o seu objetivo, resumidamente, é o de preservar o legado e fomentar a inovação e o crescimento da reprodução fiel da música gravada e partilhar a emoção do áudio de alta fidelidade com o maior número possível de pessoas. A música está presente desde muito cedo na vida da norte-americana natural de Chicago, que teve o seu primeiro giradiscos aos 12 anos. Desde então, nunca mais parou de ouvir música e adquirir equipamentos de alta fidelidade. O seu artista preferido é David Bowie e atualmente tem vários sistemas de hi-fi.
Este episódio é patrocinado por Ultimate Audio, a sua loja de referência na alta fidelidade nacional. Visite-nos em Lisboa, no Porto ou em ultimate-audio.eu.
Please introduce yourself for our audience, please.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So my name is Leslie Lundin. I am the president of the Audiophile Foundation, which is actually formerly the San Francisco Audiophile Foundation, which was formerly the San Francisco Audiophile Society, which was formerly the Bay Area Audiophile Society. So
you have formerly been a lot of things.
Yes. Yes, we have evolved.
Yeah. So please tell us a little bit about your journey into listening to good music and getting into hi-fi.
How far back would you like me to go?
That's the trick question.
In utero?
The last guest we had also asked us the same thing.
Yeah. Well, so most people say, okay, why, you know, what got you into audio in general, because the high end part obviously came later when I had more money.
Sure.
So, but you know, the lo-fi started probably when I was a teenager. And in general, the reason why I think I got into it is because my dad was an audiophile and my parents were just very musical. Not that they played musical instruments necessarily. My dad did sing, but again, not professionally, just around the house. And was a wonderful kind of operatic type singer. And so he used to love to sing. And I think sometimes he played guitar, but they just always played music. And so every morning we would wake up and we would have classical music. And then kind of midday, they would play something a little more high energy. And then, you know, in the evening, we would have jazz. And so every day really was kind of punctuated. Every part of the day was punctuated by some other type of music, which really fit the mood. And so for me, music was like the air you breathe, right? It was ubiquitous. And if it wasn't there, you really noticed it and you didn't feel whole. So that was a bit of my journey.
What about when did you get into high end?
Well, so I don't know if you call this high end, but I used to, you know, like to have people over to my house a lot, especially in college. And since I had to have music everywhere, I ended up having lots of different systems. And then I always wanted them to sound better. And so I kind of started collecting gear over time, as much as I could afford. And, you know, one thing I have to say is I regret selling everything I sold when I was young.
Sure.
I would love to have kept it all.
But it's part of the journey, isn't it?
It is part of the journey.
You keep upgrading.
You do. And I, but most people are like, I'm going to buy this. I'm going to, you know, sell this to buy this kind of thing. Yeah. And I mean, in my instance, I don't know that I necessarily needed to sell everything. You just run out of space after a while. But I look back at that old gear and I just think, oh, it would be so nice to have it. And it's really classic now. So,
sure.
And I always, as much as I could afford, I would get. Like, I just, okay. I had, or as much as I could find. I mean, I grew up in rural Wisconsin and there was not availability of great gear in Wisconsin in the like 70s and 80s. It just wasn't that much. And so I got what I could get, but I probably, the first really decent system I got was, I think my husband at the time found some article in Stereophile about how the Hafler amp married really well with these Vandersteen 2CEs, which Vandersteen 2CEs are just this classic speaker, right? And yeah. So we went on, I think, Craigslist at the time and said, oh, we found this used Hafler amp and used Vandersteen 2CEs and put that system together. And this was in Chicago. And I think it was like late 90s. Yeah, mid to late 90s. We cobbled together a system and just, it kind of took off from there. We just started looking at more Stereophile magazine and just having to get more speakers. And then I got some smaller Vandersteens, and then I got the three signatures, and then I ended up getting I moved into tube gear, and I got a bunch of CJ gear, which I do still have my CJ gear. So. Which I really, that it just, it ages well and it's beautiful and you just want to hang on to it. But then I moved into like this system now that I have, which is this kind of, yeah, the MBLs. People, I would go to the conferences, and pretty consistently, the speakers that I would always end up with at the room I would end up in at the end of the night, which many people that attend conferences do, is the MBL room.
Okay.
And this, I mean, it just, like, there was nothing that didn't sound good on those speakers. And I love, because I started with Vandersteens, I love something that's kind of open baffle, very ambient sound, and, you know, very forgiving. You can put them anywhere in a room and they just are wonderful. So.
All right, then.
That's my gear journey.
Okay. Up until now, of course. Because this is a never-ending quest.
Of course, but I have so much. I have so much stuff. I literally am running out of places to put more systems. I think I have like six different good-sized systems at this point.
So, and this one behind you is your main system, right?
It is, but that's in a different house.
Okay.
This is the main system when it was in my Ashland house. And then I moved over to Central Point, where that system is now, I use it all the time, and it is my main system, but it's in a very different room that's actually part of a home theater system. And so I have it set up so it has, I can just play two channel. Or I can have it as part of the home theater, because I just love the sound of those speakers so much.
Okay.
What amplification and sources do you have with those MBLs?
Yeah, well, so right now, and these are Merrill monoblocks. The Merrill monoblocks are actually now on a system that you saw earlier with the Devone speakers, which I do love the Devone speakers because they're very mid-century modern look and they're beautiful. The Merrills look better with those and they sound better. The Merrills cannot, you can see there, they don't now have enough power for the MBLs. And so I have the Parasound, I think JC1 pluses, monoblocks with the MBLs, and those seem to power them fine. Now, ideally, someone could say, oh, you should get the big MBL amp to go with it, which would be great, but it's ginormous. Incredibly heavy.
Yeah,
and really big. Runs hot. And I just, I like a smaller form factor. So right. I don't want this gigantic, chunky stuff. And then I do have, so for the surround portion, I've got, a Marantz surround sound preamp processor, but then I also have a Merrill preamp that is just for the two-channel system that can run separately on its own. And then in terms of cabling, I have a lot of high-fidelity cables, which now, I don't know if you know, high-fidelity is now not doing cables anymore. It's Rick Schultz's company. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's like magnetic cables.
I'm not.
It's a magnetic technology. I mean, I think they sound amazing. They're stupidly expensive, but they sounded better than anything else I have. And I even tried out one of Rick Schultz's, it's like Rick Schultz Audio now. He moved to Canada and he's producing some new cables. I have one set of his new cables, which are spectacular, I have to say. I mean, it's total snake oil, but it's really good sounding snake oil.
So, all right.
Crazy. Oh, regarding that, I always say, and I have discussed this with Fernando many times, that I do believe the placebo effect is strong, but I think it's part of it, because if you feel the placebo effect, and I'm not saying this is the case, but if and when you feel the placebo effect, and for you, it affects the way in which you are listening, then it's doing its job. And who cares if it's just a placebo effect or a real effect? If at the end of the day, if it sounds better for you, that's all it matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's amazing how it sounds better for everyone in the room too.
So it's maybe not just the placebo effect, and it's not snake oil. So
yeah, no, I mean it is kind of amazing the difference cables make. That's what I've found, is pretty consistently it's almost like you really can take some pretty inexpensive gear and put some really nice, and they don't have to be expensive, cables on, well-chosen cables, and it really upgrades your entire system if you know what you're doing. I mean, even the even improving the signal, something we talk about a lot at the foundation, if you wanted to segue into that, is doing A-B comparisons and just talking about kind of tweaks and these little inexpensive things you can do to massively improve your system. Because a lot of people say, okay, well, I need to go buy this like $10,000 DAC and that's going to make all the difference. I'm like, no, keep your $500 DAC or $1,000 DAC. Instead, work on your signal. You know, if you're connected via Ethernet, which we strongly recommend, just put a fiber patch in. Makes a huge difference. That will probably make a bigger difference than what you think you're doing with your DAC, because it's like garbage in, garbage out. If you don't have a better signal, you got nothing to work with.
Yeah. Sure.
So.
Yeah. But I was exactly going to ask you, and you already told us before the recording started. What is the actual purpose of the San Francisco Audiophile Society? Because you told us that the idea is a little bit like the consumer reports of high fidelity.
Our mission, ever since what was Alon Sigi and I took over in 2014, we took over Bay Area Audiophile, BAS, Bay Area Audiophile Society. We took it over and we're like, well, we want every event we do to be educational. We're not going to pitch. People are going to come and they're going to get nothing paid for information. So you're going to come to an event, you're going to talk to other people that have the same gear, you're going to audition gear. Nobody's trying to sell you anything. All we want to do is give you information and share information. So as we started doing more of that and we started doing more things that were educational, people started saying, well, okay, you know, my father just passed away and he you know, loved your group and you were so important for him, but I don't know what to do with this and I don't want it to end up at Goodwill or in the junk heap somewhere. So we would say, okay, well, we'll try to help you sell it, but we didn't really have the means to do these things. And they're like, well, we'll just give it to you. I'm like, well, we don't really take donations. So I said, why don't we form a 501c3 so we can take donations and we can, you know, we can sell things, we can take things in, we can have real educational events. Cause we were moving in the direction of really kind of needing to educate the community, which is always something that we wanted to do, and provide services for members and members' families. And so people are now like, I don't know if you saw when we were talking about the KFOG collection on the Fremmer, at the Fremmer event. So part of what we basically every few years we fly out Fremmer and he does an in-person event because he's very popular. He's a wonderful, wonderful speaker.
Yeah.
And just fantastic guy. And so we had donated roughly 4,000 records, which were the original KFOG, which is a radio station, a very famous radio station in San Francisco that was formed in the, I think it was in the, like the 60s. And it was an easy listening station. And Pete Taylor was the original DJ for KFOG. So he subsequently moved to Tacoma, Washington, and was given the entire collection when they changed from easy listening to their current format, which, you know, they went through rock and roll and now, you know, they're very different now. But basically he had been just sitting on this entire collection, which is pristine. And it's basically 50s, 60s, and a little bit of the 70s, kind of easy listening-ish records. Like, you know, cocktail music, just...
Yeah. I saw some of the records that Fremmer show, that Michael Fremmer show. Those were beautiful.
Oh, they're amazing. And when we were going through them, so basically, because...
He actually got surprised by some of them in the collection. Yeah.
He was shocked.
He's not an easy person to be surprised with.
I know. Yeah. I mean, as he was going through them, he's like, I've never seen this record. I've never seen this record. Like, he was finding record after record that he literally had just never seen. So we're like, well, we're, you know, part of what we also want to do, part of our mission is preservation. So he's like, well, you know, there was the Capitol Records fire and all these Command records, like they were all destroyed. So if you've got early pressings, which the vast majority of these are very, very early pressings because they were kind of radio DJ issues and pristine, like some of them barely played, some had never been opened. And so he said, you need to kind of hang on to those. You don't want to just, you know, sell them off for a couple bucks a piece. So we were trying to get him to pull out the ones that we really should kind of keep and preserve in our foundation collection, because ultimately, maybe 20 or 30 years from now, we would want to have a museum. And so we've started just collecting really, you know, collectible pieces, iconic gear and media. And people will be donating things over time. So part of our mission really is education. And it's education kind of on the DIY front, or education as to, you know, how to be a smart buyer. Part of it is creating community, which is how do we connect audiophiles really all over the world? It's more than just like in this little local area, because in general, people are so spread out these days. And even in the Bay Area, you could be a couple hours from someone and you really want to see them, and you would have no idea that they existed or what they have. So on our website, we have the ability to, you know, post pictures of your system, your bio, things you're interested in. We have all these different forums so people can reach out. And then, like, let's say you're a member and you know, you live in Lisbon and you want to go to San Francisco and meet some audiophiles. You can go on as a member and say, oh, well, you know, these people look interesting, and just reach out to them. And it's like you have an instant friend group wherever you go around the world, as long as we have members there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And so that's kind of part of it, is bringing people together and just having someone just to talk to and ask questions. So we get a lot of questions, almost like a helpline. You know, I've got this issue with my system. You know, Buzz is a big, everybody has Buzzes in their systems. So, like, how do you troubleshoot your Buzzes? And because a lot of our members and volunteers are retired, so they have time, and they're really interested in talking to other audiophiles. Like, they just like it. And even if it's troubleshooting a system, like, everybody, it's this just like sickness we have.
We're trying to
figure out why things are not perfect, and we like to help other people in their quest as well. So you just have all these like-minded people, and we're just trying to bring them together. So there's that, and then there's the hopefully someday we'll have a museum where we'll be able to preserve things, and you know, we can have a little coffee shop and vinyl shop where people can hang out and kibitz and do things like that.
So we have how many associates do you have? Do you have an idea?
Members?
I
think right now, just in terms of our email list, I think we have like 1,100 people or something. It's mostly Western US, the vast majority in California. And then maybe 300 plus actual members. So
anyone can be a member of the,
anyone
of the
can join.
Foundation? Even from abroad?
Yeah. Anyone can join. I mean, we don't do soliciting outside of really our main little region. But it's kind of like word of mouth, or we'll go, kind of the one time we do solicit is we'll go to Expona. And so we're registered. If we do direct solicitation, for 501c3 parlance, that means that you're doing money raising, which means that we have to register. So we are registered in Illinois, California, Washington, and Oregon right now. And if we did have, like, let's say there was a group of audiophiles in New York that all wanted to join, we would then register in New York to make sure that we are properly registered. We're very, very focused on doing everything legally correctly.
Yeah, of course. So in a hobby, let's call it a hobby like this, where mostly we find men, how does a woman ends up heading
by default? No, what happened? Well, and I'm used to running organizations. It was not my goal in life to be running an audiophile foundation. It just kind of blew up. I mean, thing is that...
Just happened.
It's one of those things. Over the years, it just develops and it grows. And we kept getting more volunteers that would come in, and they're really highly skilled, and they would have a lot of energy. And they're like, oh, well, let's do this and let's do that. I'm like, okay. And so that's how we end up doing all these things and being very active. And then we're like, well, we put so much effort into building this website and this machine that only serves like 300 or so, you know, 1,000 people right now. It could serve 20,000. It wouldn't cost us much more. So, and what we found is that when you talk to a lot of the audiophile groups, you know, they're not like formal groups. They don't have the bells and whistles that we have. And they usually end up like with one person doing all the work, and then they just burn out and they stop and it kind of falls apart. I'm like, well, to keep it alive, people could just join our group. It's $30 a year, basically, to join the group. And you get everything, you get all the functionality that we have, and you could have your own individual groups. And then you don't die out, because people just keep joining in your area, and you have a means to reach them. And frankly, you have a means to reach people everywhere. And then we could piggyback on the events, each other's virtual events, which is great. So we're not just duplicating things all the time. So that's where we are now.
Yeah, that's great. Are there many audiophile women in your foundation?
Other women. We do have other female members. Some, not a lot. And we do try to encourage women, but like I can't force, you know, we can't force women to buy gear and set up systems. It seems like women are somewhat averse to the whole complicated system idea. So even my system, like, and I love setting up systems. I don't know what it is. It's weird. I just really like setting up systems. It's a thing I do. Most women don't do that.
You know something, Leslie? Right now, at this point in my life, I really can relate. I learned to love simple stuff. I don't have the energy or the patience anymore to set up stuff and to find out what went wrong and debug an issue. I think that for many years I really enjoy the hardware part, the equipment and the mix and matching of components, etc. And now I'm really over it. Maybe women are more advanced than men because they have just passed that phase and are now in the wise phase that we are. So,
well, but for me, I've always, like, my hobbies have always been more kind of male populated hobbies. Like, Fernando, I see you're into cars.
Like, I do.
Love cars.
You
like
do.
I have three Porsches.
You so, do.
Wow.
Yeah, I have a 944.
You're starting to annoy me. You have a big system, a great system behind you, and you have three Porsches. I have miniatures of Porsches.
Okay.
That's all I can get.
I just love cars. I mean, that's the thing. Or real estate. So what I do professionally is
911s?
I have a 1984 944, and then I have a 2001 996, which is like the 9911 C4 cab. And then I have a 2017 Macan S. So they're not too fancy, but I just really like them. I would not sell.
You have the bases all covered with those three.
Yeah. Yeah. But the 944, unfortunately, right now is not working, which I think is common for 944s. But yeah, I mean, so the thing is that my brain seems to work very well in what I think is typically dominated, male-dominated space. It's more engineering based. And I think a lot of women that I have seen that are interested in the space tend to be more kind of engineers, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily musicians, but someone who has kind of a more mathematic or more engineer brain. I mean, because there's a big connection between like math and music, right?
Yeah.
It's a very common thing. The math brain is like the music brain.
And what about the young generation in the US, or maybe in the California area? Are there younger audiophiles?
There are. Actually, in the Bay Area, there is a group, but they tend to be more into headphones, which is pretty common. So, yeah. So there's one of our members who puts together pretty decent sized headphone events. And we're trying to get them to kind of cross over. And I think at a certain age and when you're living in a certain location, headphones make a lot more sense. You're not going to have a big system. But
sure. Yeah, it's an interesting way to access high quality music reproduction through a good pair of headphones. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, like Shit Audio, you know, Shit S.
Yeah.
The company.
Yes.
They've done a great job of marketing and creating products that are excellent quality entry level products. And I think you can also move up with them. Like I have so many shit products because they always sound good. Like yeah. You pop them in and out of system, they work really well. And like their Yigi DAC, I love their DAC. It's just that I actually have right now. I had their Yigi OG DAC in my main system because it sounded that good. And I actually just switched it out for an AMR DAC, which also sounds very good. It's a tube DAC, a little bit okay. of a pain, but still sounds wonderful. But still, I mean, they have, I think you can do entry level with shit. A couple hundred dollars, you can get yourself a nice headphone amp yeah. for your headphones, and then you can move up. And I think they're a good gateway for young consumers. And I think that's kind of their plan to a certain extent, which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of companies that would like their entry level products are $5,000. Like you're it's going to be hard to
sell
to $5,000.
Yeah, for sure.
To
yeah. Sure. yeah. You have to start at $200
yeah.
and then work your way up.
Yeah.
So, sure. I'm glad that they are doing that, and they really are a wonderful company. And we interviewed them, I think a couple months ago, we did a Zoom interview with them. So, so we're trying to get as many like women and younger listeners in as possible. I don't know, Devin Turnbull.
Yeah, I do. Actually, I was going to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah. Devin, he just did his show at SF MoMA, which I think yeah. just left a couple months ago.
It already left? Okay. I'm pretty sure
it left. Yeah. It was mainly over the summer. And I did go to it. It was very well attended, but mostly like young people and a lot of women very interested. And I mean, the vinyl resurgence has really done a lot, I think, for high-end audio, because once you have a turntable, you're like, okay, well, I need something with a phono stage, and it kind of gets you into thinking about listening to a better system.
Yeah.
Like I have three sons, and they grew up A-B-ing equipment. So whenever I put in different cables or, you know, different DACs and things, I'm like, okay, kids, I'd set them down on the couch and like, well, tell me which one you like better. Because they have the best ears. They hear everything.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
Because I had my three little boys, and I figured they would be kind of, you know, weaned on music and really become excellent listeners. So now, luckily, all three of them are kind of into music. And I actually just bought, what's funny is, so two of my sons are in New York City, and one of them really loves finding things on the street. There's a thing.
You walk around the street.
People move, yes, Goodwill and on the street, right? They're young, they're in their 20s. And so he got a good turntable on the street, worked fine. And then he started finding the old Andrew Jones Pioneer speakers. So the really old Pioneer, when Andrew Jones was there, and they were like the signature series.
Yeah, I had one of these. I had one of those, yeah.
Yeah, and
The little ones.
Yeah, they're like this big. Yeah.
I had them on this office, actually. I sold them. Here maybe a year ago.
Well, they're classic.
They sounded great.
Yeah.
Inexpensive. So
he found one at $20 or for $20 at Goodwill. Just one.
Wow.
Not two.
Oh, just one.
I bought. I bought the two of them for I don't know maybe $40.
Maybe yeah, 50? That's the price.
Yeah. But they're great speakers and made by Andrew Jones. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, they're phenomenal speakers. They're actually, I think Alon had a pair of them, and when we did one of our first events, he brought a pair of those speakers to show people how good they were and to compare them to higher end speakers. They punch way above their weight class. He'd go to Goodwill and he'd find these speakers and send me, I'm like, you've got to buy that. And so he started collecting bits and pieces of a system. And so he's my youngest son. He was the first to kind of put together like a real little audiophile-ish system off of little found things or cheap things he got on Facebook Marketplace. And then my older son, I actually got some more Andrew Jones speakers when he was at ELAC. at a rummage sale, which is surprising, and got those and gave them to my other son who's in New York, and now he's, and I had given him a turntable prior to that, so now he's got his own nice system. So they're like well on their way to overspending on high-end audio.
All right.
Great. So, but it's good to know that there is a new generation of people interested in.
The legacy will continue.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Yeah,
yeah. So, I mean, so vinyl sales are still there.
So. Yeah. speaking about that, how do you see the audiophile industry in the U.S.?
You know, on the high end, and I kind of had this conversation. Actually, I talked to Michael Frommer yesterday and I asked, we were talking about how do you make money in high-end audio? It's the same as like if you have a winery, it's like, how do you make a small fortune in the wine industry? Start with a large one.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. So a lot of the manufacturers are, you know, they come in with money and they're just passionate about it and they want to do something because it's really fun and they like the industry. But I don't know how much money you really make. Now, Michael would say, yes, there is money. Somebody's making money out there. But, you know, everyone's private. So how do you find the numbers on these things? It's all anecdotal. Mm. I mean, you see vinyl sales, right? Those numbers you can get.
Sure.
If you can trust them.
Yeah, true. And in the case of vinyl sales, we are usually talking about big increases year on year, but they are coming from very, very, very low sales. So it although there is a kind of resurgence on the format, but the total sales of vinyl are still, and they will probably be for the foreseeable future, are still very, very low comparatively to the big heyday on the late 80s, probably.
Yeah. Well, I mean, physical media like vinyl, it's like owning a piece of art at this point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, people are very selective because, you know, they want to have something that...
There's actually young people that are buying, but not to play them, not necessarily to play them. Just to collect them.
Yeah, because they're beautiful. I mean, for $30, you get a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you do.
True. Yeah, true.
Yeah.
And you were talking a while ago about how good $200 earphones can sound, for instance. Do you think this is something that the industry should do more in order to entice a new generation of people coming into this hobby, like enticing them with good value for money products, mm-hmm. but then saying, "Oh, you like this? And yeah, this is cheap, but for X more, we also have this, and we are going to show you how different." It can be and how better it can be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I like the entry level products. And the thing is, like, what was interesting is when my son was shopping around for a receiver for the new Elax, or the new used Elax that I got him, he's like, I need a receiver that has a phono stage and also does home theater, and that's also will stream. He wanted an all-in-one thing,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he wanted all-in-one. And so I gave him some recommendations, and I gave him a recommendation that was $1,700. he's like, well, that's a bit much. And he ended up finding something, may not sound as good, but he ended up finding, I think, a new Marantz product. And he also wanted a small form factor, so small, not big, chunky thing. He wanted a small, attractive, inexpensive piece, and he ended up getting this new Marantz product that did everything and had a phono stage for brand new $600. I mean, I was amazed. I looked it up to like 2024 product of the year or something. So you've got, I mean, people that are clearly looking for it. And Marantz also just came out with like a beautiful high-end line. They met anything I'd ever seen. They're trying to move people up. And as I said, I have a Marantz around the suit. I actually souped it up. So I modded it, but it's fantastic. I mean, it's not my main system, but for my surround, it was really, really excellent. So there are manufacturers doing that, and there are people interested, but I think it's very hard, again, if you start at a very high end, to get people to jump over there. And a lot of the high end products, they don't produce as much. And my fear, and this is part of what I think is important as a mission for the foundation, is you have a lot of kind of small one-man shop manufacturers jumping into the fray, trying to sell, you know, $5,000 cables and then disappearing.
It's the same here in Europe.
And that's something you have to be really aware of, because, you know, if you buy something and it malfunctions and it's, you know, the tech and the architecture of it is so complicated that you can't find anyone that knows how to fix it. Like, you just toss $5,000 out the window.
And
that doesn't make people feel very good. So we want to try to help people not make those mistakes.
That's
a good thing.
Also, talking about the high-end, here, at least here in Portugal, we have a tendency to equate an audio file to someone that has high-end gear. But from our conversation, I don't think that is the case from your organization, or even what you think. You can be an audiophile, but not have high-end gear. It's not a requirement.
Yeah. It's more of just striving for better sound, right? And I mean, it does. Yeah. I mean, you don't. And the thing is that you can have high-end gear and not be an audiophile. You can just say, you can just have a lot of money.
Good point.
And
say,
I'm just going to go, I'm going to buy an expensive system, I'm going to plug it in here because it looks good. Boom. You're not an audiophile. I'm sorry. You just have too much money.
Good point.
I mean, an audiophile is a certain kind of brain that it's almost like a drug. You know, music is a drug. Your body reacts to music, and certain people's bodies react a little more, or they recognize it more. And it does, when you hear it, it makes you feel a certain way, and you just want more of that feeling. And it's like the best drug for you. It doesn't hurt you, only helps you. You know, and whatever mood you want to be in, you can put on your music, and it'll get you there.
Sure.
Which is the amazing thing about music. That's why we love it.
It is
true. So, Leslie, what is your preferred source for listen to music? Is it digital or vinyl?
Yeah, I tend to stream more than anything. Just because, I mean, I do love the sound of vinyl, but it takes, you have to sit down, you have to, you gotta listen to it. But I'm a little hyper. So I have a hard time just sitting still for long periods of time.
Yeah.
I noticed that. So for me, I'm like, I'll put music on and run around to it. And I used to, you know, this is the one downside of running an audio-based foundation, because I do so much audio stuff now, and I do so much A/B listening. I do way less of my like therapeutic listening. Like, I used to sit down and just
geek
out and just listen to music and really enjoy it. And I'm so busy swapping things in and out and fixing systems and listening to records that I have to listen to. I don't get as much time to do that, which is kind of unfortunate. But I do pretty much, whenever I can, I play music.
That's great.
But it tends to be digital just because it's convenient.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you already told us the hi-fi system that you have at home. At several homes, actually, but up until now, do you have an idea or a recollection of what was the hi-fi system that you heard somewhere or at a fair or a presentation or at someone else's home that really impressed you the most, besides your own?
Well, as I said, and I used to love the MDL systems the best. Jeremy, who's the U.S. Distributor, like, would always put together the most amazing systems at all the events. And so and the extremes are unbelievable. The MBL extremes, they're the just gigantic. Ones. But yeah, the really big ones, they're amazing. So those have always been my favorites, hence why I purchased them. I hear a lot of good systems, you know. And what's funny, the funny thing is, when I go to shows with people or we have events, you know, we'll have events where we go to people's houses because we love doing syshops, where someone, you know, they only have like 4 seats in their living room, but they want people to come listen. And so we encourage people to say, open your home and have people come and listen to your system and talk about your system. It's a great thing to get them together. We do that a lot.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, you guys should do that.
Yeah, maybe we will. We will.
Yeah. Maybe we will.
Well, yeah, because if you put all this time into your system and you have your favorite music and everything, and so you want to show it off and you want to talk to other people about it. It doesn't have to be a solo endeavor. So, but you'll go to people's houses and you listen to their systems, and pretty consistently people are like, oh, that's a fantastic system, but I love my system better. It doesn't matter what it is. Because you tune your system to your ears and your body, in your room.
True.
And so people, it's like a glove. You make it kind of fit what you like.
Yeah.
And so, and then, you know, obviously you keep tweaking it so you like it better and better, but pretty consistently our membership.
But you are tweaking it for yourself.
For yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone into people's houses and they have phenomenal systems, you know, on paper, it's great. But like, and they'll put on something that they really love, and like literally it will hurt my ears. Like I'm like, it's tuned, because a lot of as they age, the high frequency responds, they just don't pick it up. Whereas I'm much more sensitive. So I come in and I'm like, are you not hearing that?
Yeah.
And I like, it just, it's too much high frequency. So it's just, it was tuned to someone who had issues with, you know, they just didn't have, they couldn't hear it.
They don't realize it.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone into people's systems where they've got 2 subwoofers sitting there, and I'll say, okay, we'll play one of the tunes I'm familiar with. And I'm like, I'm seeing 2 subwoofers, but I'm not hearing them doing anything.
Yeah.
I know what this should sound like, but you're missing this range. And they go back and they're like, oh, sure enough, they're not on.
It's too bad.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. So like, you just, you know, you get used to a certain sound, and that sound is very comforting. It's like if, you know, whoever your partner is, you know, hopefully you like the sound of their voice, right? And that just becomes like your call.
Yeah.
At least that works that way for me.
Yeah.
You tune yourself into other people. So, yeah.
So Leslie, we are getting to the end of our interview. So, and at the end, we always ask our interview a question. And it is, which song you can get out of your head?
Lately.
Oh.
Is there one?
No,
it can be it can be a music, an LP, an artist.
Well, no, it's funny because there's 2 songs, I don't know why, that for years I cannot get out of my head, and you would laugh.
Never.
Heard them.
Never.
So one's a Madonna song. and the other's a I think the other one's a Britney Spears song. Ba-da, ba-da, oh, baby, baby, what am I? You know that song?
Yes.
Okay. I think I do.
That song. That song, I have not been able to get out of my head for like 15 years.
It's like a earworm, right?
It is. It's really weird. Yeah. Yeah, and then I think the Madonna, I think it's Like a Prayer, that song. I love cranking
like
that
song. Like a
Prayer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and
it's weird. So
no,
I don't know why.
No. and lately, what music or artist did you discover that you thought, oh wow?
There's a bunch actually, because when I go out on my kind of walk runs, I can't really run. I just walk fast. I try to go on Qobuz and find a new artist like every time.
Oh,
and so nice. I think it's like the last one I was listening to is like the X. It's not the XX, but it's the former member. Here, hold on. Of the XX. Oh, and then my kids are constantly trying to turn me on. Oh, Jamie XX.
Jamie XX. Okay.
Jamie XX.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard that. It's really good. It's good workout stuff. And then
I actually saw the band a couple of years ago.
It is the same as the guy, one of the people from XX, though, right?
Yeah.
Which I used to listen to.
Yeah.
XX. Yeah. And then my kids were turning me on to here, this Sierra Farrell. I'm supposed to listen to her, I think.
All right.
Farrell.
I'm not familiar
with that. Then.
And then before that, Chapel Rowan. But
oh, yeah. Chapel Rowan. It's the girl of the moment.
Yeah.
Okay. I love Chapel Rowan.
You like her?
Oh, I love it.
So my kids, because when they were growing up, I always used to force music on them. So they grew up with like kind of 90s, 2000s alt rockish stuff.
So now they are forcing music.
They are. Yes, they're like when I see them, they're like, oh, you need to listen to these people.
The Revenge of the Kids.
I know. So I was trying to see, and I always try to put it on my little list here.
Do you like Billie Eilish?
I love Billie Eilish. Yes.
Yeah.
No, I do like Billie Eilish.
She's great. Yeah.
She is great.
Yeah.
Yes. So So that's what I am always trying to find new music.
Yeah, that's a great thing.
Beauty of streaming.
Oh, yeah.
That unites us. Audiophiles. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, Leslie. So it was great. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah. Great pleasure to meet you and have this conversation.
Great meeting you as well.
Yeah.
And hopefully,
hopefully we'll get two new members from Portugal.
Yeah,
that'd be awesome. Yeah. And if you're ever in Southern Oregon, which is where I am, or the Bay Area, you gotta look us up.
Yeah. Now we'll I'm
do.
Curious to listen to your system. So
yes, yes. If you find yourself in Medford, Oregon, or Ashland, then
all right.
Come and hear it.
Okay.
So, bye-bye.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Ciao. Ciao. All right. Take care.